Hi, welcome to Contemporary Communications Conference. My name is Jerry Fialka, and I'm sitting here with Mark Free, who is an unknown significant American, that's a USA, and a multimedia composer. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Jerry. How are you doing?
Good. Today we're going to discuss Bob's dialogue entitled Entertainment Sucks and other various Bob documents.
And related topics, I guess.
All right.
I thought we would just start looking through and trying to find key phrases that need to be glossarized.
Good.
For which there may be a work could be produced of the best of Bob explaining in a glossary type of form.
I've always wanted to do this because I find that is what hinders most people from understanding Bob, is that he throws out too many terms too fast. And the problem is that if you take the line that Bob's dogma changes every 15 seconds, that once he defines a term, 15 seconds later, the term is going to be changed. But, snicker, snicker. But I think it's still helpful because there are terms that he uses often that probably remain somewhat consistent with a meaning.
Well, seeing how most of Bob's communications are essentially modeled after the Platonic dialogue.
What's
method.
Platonic mean?
Platonic meaning as of relating to Plato, the ancient Greek philosopher who was one of the first people to put out. Bob actually mentions in here the Platonic dialogues as an early form of turning human speech into art form. And
so that's what you mean by Platonic dialogues?
Platonic dialogues were a series of documents that were produced to historically record the work of Socrates, essentially, who was Plato's master and teacher, who did not, Socrates did not write anything down. He did not produce any books. He merely taught people. He was, you know, their master, so to speak. And Plato was one of his biggest students and recorded some of the dialogues they would write down. He would gather together with certain eminent philosophical figures in ancient Greece and debate hot philosophical topics such as, you know, can the just man commit injustice, and is the fate or you know, so on and so forth. But
is Platonic dialogues actually Socrates' teachings?
The Socratic teachings are generally considered to be represented inside of the dialogues.
Inside of Platonic.
Yeah, Plato is the writer, though. I mean, Plato.
So it's Plato's interpretation of Socrates.
Right. I mean, they're presented as though you're supposed to imagine that they're a transcription. You know, as though somebody actually sat down there and just read. And some of them are. You know, some of it is actually probably a pretty faithful transcription. But a lot of it also, just to make his point, Plato developed certain dialogues. You know, some
of his own, to
present the whole philosophy as he saw it. Okay.
So that's just like Bob doing McLuhan. He's just taking McLuhanisms and calling them as his own. And it's just like me spouting off Bob's stuff.
To some extent, yeah.
Okay.
But you're not writing. Bob's not gone. It has. You see, what happened was Socrates was condemned by his state and forced to drink hemlock. He obviously couldn't do any more work at a certain point. And to preserve his teachings, Plato produced these roots, just as much as Bob, to preserve McLuhan's teachings, has produced a certain amount of work. And when Bob is gone, maybe we'll have to produce works of Bob, or so to speak.
Okay.
But the general idea I was saying as a form is just the idea that there's a dialogue going on between characters in which they try to develop and discuss, maybe even, you know, not necessarily just argue, where I have the, A has a certain opinion and B has a certain opinion, and we just get to watch them bash. Instead, the idea was that you watch them interact and you watch them each take issue with the smaller points of each other's argument to try to work it out till they can find something that they both...
To have an insight?
Yeah, exactly, to have an insight about, you know, like, I mean, I don't want to get into specific Platonic dialogues, but the idea here is that in this particular thing, we have Bob having a dialogue with you and with Connie, and even though Bob talks most, the other characters do interject ideas and somewhat direct and stir the direction
right.
that the dialogue goes. What is missing, however, for me, in the Platonic dialogues, is there's a certain thing that he's creating here. It's called the dialectic, which is how we discover knowledge through discussion.
Right. Now, what is missing in Entertainment Sucks?
What's missing from the entire work of Bob and the many dialogues that are available.
Not just Entertainment Sucks.
Not just Entertainment Sucks. Okay. Is a preliminary set of dialogues that explain the terms because that part of the discussion is called the elenchus. When you have the in philosophy, like if Socrates wants to talk about a term, they do a whole dialogue on that term. As imagine we did a whole dialogue on Menippean satire with
right.
Bob, where all we did was talk about it, so that after you had finished that dialogue, you had somewhere developed your concept of
right.
what it was. Then later, when we get into the serious later dialogues, you'll have already had all these earlier dialogues that have already established these terms through what was called the elenchus. Okay, the elenchus was basically where we put out a term, and I say it means A, and you say it means B, and we argue about it until we finally get a meaning C, which either contains or doesn't contain
right.
our points of view. So once we reach that point C, we go, okay, it means this, and this is what it's going to mean for purposes of this discussion.
Right.
Not that this is the end-all definition. That's why when Bob says that the definitions change, that's fine.
Right.
But the idea is that at some point when we're having the discussion,
oh,
we
good.
Have to agree right now for this discussion, this is what this term means.
So an elenchus is a glossary.
Right. Like if I was having a discussion with a guy who was an art critic and I said that work was bad, that would mean the work was terrible. But by the same thing, by having a different elenchus, if I was getting together with a jazz musician and I said that horn part was bad, it would mean the opposite. It would mean it
right.
was good.
Right.
So the elenchus establishes the environment between the people in the dialogue
right.
and what the terms are going to mean. And so in a sense, I'm saying there are terms in here, in Entertainment Sucks, that with some kind of preliminary dialogue or glossary of some sort, a more advanced understanding of these words would facilitate a more easier and cohesive direct reading of the dialogue. There's just too many times where you have to stop and break the flow of what Bob is saying to try to figure out what a certain term means. There's also cases where he uses interchangeable terms,
mm-hmm.
such as human scale or anthropomorphic scale,
mm-hmm.
and it is not really clear as to whether each of them has specific meanings or whether they are just directly interchangeable.
Right.
Now, it seems in that case that they are directly interchangeable.
Right.
But
so that's what the purpose of this tape
that's
Robbie,
a major
is to
part
review
of, is to find out which terms they are that need this development.
And then Bob hearing this, maybe he will
begin this series of dialogues to lay out.
Right, because he'll immediately say he's already done this, because he has in a lot of ways, and he'll also say,
well, if Bob can point us towards those dialogues that have already been constructed, and I can
right.
I can read them, or they could be produced, that would be fine.
Yeah, and the other one is he'll say study the 10 holy offices, because each one of those is the roots of the most of the terms.
Well, that's fine. Does he want to put out a primer on the 10 holy offices before people read his book, or does he want people to read his book and then find that to the way back to the offices? I think that's more what he wants you to do. Is
he wants to read your book first.
He wants you to read him
book first.
And discover these other people on a new level
back.
And then go back and go into them rather than spending all this time with them and not getting to his centralized picture, because each of these people represent...
Well, that's a good question to ask him right off the bat.
You know.
Which order?
We need to probably write that down then and make sure that...
He'll just listen to this. This conference is basically for him.
Conference for Bob. Okay, you have producers
C for
Bob.
B.
This is discussers for Bob. Anyhow, so we'll go to the prologue.
Okay.
And the first specialized term other than fata communion...
Phatic.
A phatic part.
You want me to tell you what phatic communion is first?
Sure, that would be fine.
Okay. The name of Bob's book is Phatic Communion with Bob Dobbs. Phatic communion is basically...
Just try phatic. Don't.
Right, but it's a typical phatic communion situation would be you're fixing a flat tire on the side of the road, and I come up to you, and I say, got a flat tire? Well, of course you've got a flat tire. It's evident. Both of us can see that, and you're fixing it. But you're sociable, and you're not going to go and snap at me. You're going to go, yeah.
I'm going to say, I am not going to get crass. Or
right.
Or if I'm funny, I might say, no shit.
Yeah, and it's social communication. So it's like people going, hey, nice weather today, or how are you doing? Fine.
So
it's not really, it's surface communication.
So we would maybe... recall something that's phatic as something that restates the obvious?
That probably is accurate. It's
so
social communication.
So a phatic communion would be any type of situation where people get together and discuss the already known or the obvious.
That sounds Correct.
All right, well, maybe we have a good, that maybe that's a good enough working definition for that, that something could be developed out of that.
Right.
Okay, next, now we keep going down, and obviously Bob's Media Ecology, that's just basically the title of the master plan. I don't think that needs to be
delineated.
I think that's pretty self-explanatory. Ecology is a well-understood term, and so is media. And anyhow, so then the first thing that comes in is when we get to Bob's introduction where he says, I say human scale. And human scale is one of his specialized terms.
That is.
Okay, so we'll highlight that.
Okay.
Okay, and we'll go down. And I think the next thing that we have is mixed corporate media, which is
right.
Which for me is
What you should do is you should take each term and tell us what you think it possibly means. So read the line first.
Right.
I'll say, I say human scale is a reflex reaction to the situation we've come to in our mixed corporate media effects.
Okay, and it keeps going on.
And I don't have any identification with anything that's going on. So how do you think he means human scale?
Well, human scale seems to be a perspective generated out of having, as he says, the anthropomorphic form that comes out of the human condition, the human life, the basic... Okay. So it's very
personal.
Yeah, personal, but not only personal on a level, but a transcendental level where they're, I mean, everybody on the planet does certain things, no matter whether they're rich or poor. Everybody breathes in and breathes out. That's
right.
That's a human thing.
Right.
Everybody has a certain, you know, I mean, ideally, we're not talking about people have serious genetic damage or whatever, but it's pretty much not normal, but standard, let us say, person has a certain number of hands and feet and you know, washes their face and goes to the bathroom and wants to eat and wants to have a drink of water. And you know, those things are all the human condition, are also the human scale to some extent.
Right.
From what I could perceive. So when you're taking a concept and trying to bring it down to a human scale, you know, like you could take something like a math equation.
Right.
And bring it down to the human scale by showing how, you know,
how
humans use that knowledge practically.
Like with dividing your apples for your dinner.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
You know, or even more complicated things, you know.
Okay.
But a human scale effect would be, to me, would be the way that we interpret the things that are going on in the universe. We are, if we have not transcended the concept that we are just our bodies, or that we are humans that are so different from everything else, then we only can perceive things within our, you know, kind of intelligible awareness. So to speak, like, the basic story I see of illumination, this kind of sideline, is that somebody goes away and nobody, whoever he is.
Say it again. You're defining what
the
illumination is.
The basic model
is
for illumination in the West, how it happens, or initiation, is that somebody goes away, nobody, and something happens to them, and they come back as somebody. Like Moses goes off into the desert, and Jesus goes off wandering in the wilderness, and so on and so forth. And at some point, or Muhammad goes in a cave.
Right.
You know, and at some point, this illumination is bestowed upon them, or dawns on them. Dawn is really the best term because the light comes out of the darkness so they can see.
Because it's just there. They're just the vehicle.
Right. So
for
they've
it.
Had this illumination, which is beyond words, which is just merely it's an image essentially of the universe, I think, that they perceive, or of the order of the universe.
Uh-huh.
But when they come back from that and they come back into society, when Muhammad comes back, when Moses comes down off the mountain, they have to relay that illumination to the other people only within the terms that they had before they went.
Right.
So when Muhammad goes, he only has the terminology, or Moses, they only have the terminology or the mythic images that they had before they had the illumination with which to relay it back to
the
other people.
Very good.
So the human scale is essentially the refining and the limiting of the transcendental image of the illumination into a form or words or image, which someone else not having directly been that person who had that illumination in terms of a corporeal form is able to grasp.
Right.
You know, I mean, we might hang out with some physicists who have a serious understanding of gravity and stuff like that. And for them, maybe they could talk to each other within a very specified lexicon or use terms. But if they want to explain Newton's law of universal gravity to anybody, they just explain the thing where the apple falls from the tree and hits the guy on the head.
Uh-huh.
You know, because everybody will seriously just grasp what goes up comes down.
Right.
You know, that's another way of stating it. However, if I was talking to them, I might say, well, G1 equals the mass of one times the other mass of the other over the square of the distance and give you some specific, you know, math formula. But that's not a human scale thing. That's a right. That's a mathematical scale.
Right.
But the human scale is to say what goes up must comes down or watch out for heavy things over your head in an earthquake. yeah, exploration. Just remember, it's not speed that kills. It's only rapid deceleration.
So that was a good definition of human scale. So we'll see what Bob has to add to that.
For my dollar, that seems to be what human or anthropomorphic scale is. Another example of the human scale or the anthropomorphic limitation is when most people take LSD or mushrooms or other mind-expanding chemicals, so-called psychedelic substances, one of the general first illusions of which they become aware, hesitant to call it a hallucination that people have is seeing faces and other things. I mean, I can say for myself,
right.
You guys can say, oh, I saw a face in that tree or in
right.
that wall. And what that is to me is your being is trying to tell you that you and that rock or you and that tree are essentially one.
Wow.
You're made out of the same stuff. But the only way you're so hung up in being a human and how great that is, that the only way you'll identify with it is if you see a human face and if you anthropomorphize the tree or the
good.
Wall or whatever. And that seems to be the first realization that almost everyone I've ever talked to about those type of psychedelic experience has experienced at one time or another. They've seen that face in the wall. And then people who become more aware of this interconnectedness, this identity, underlying identity of between things, they seem to get away from that face thing. And now, for myself and for other people I know, it's more of seeing a small tile or a small, like, pattern. For me, it looks like little pyramids of different sizes that are in everything. It's like this master tile pattern, mosaic, that's in every object, inside the cosmic cookie dough, as I've referred to.
So you see this pattern
as opposed
instead
to seeing
of
the
faces.
Face, because now I can just see the interconnectedness of all things instead of being on a human scale. We've kind of gone beyond the human scale, but then I'm bringing it back to the human scale to relate it to you, see? My revelation of it was first, well, then all these things have some kind of human factor to them with a face on it.
Right.
But then as I transcended that belief and discovered that it was just about life,
right.
about creativity, about light,
right.
that there was another pattern, a diffraction or a refraction grating or a mosaic tile pattern that was in all things that could be perceived, that was as equally in the TV guide as it was in a wood chair, as it was in a rock, as
right.
it was in a crystal of sand on the beach. All of them, when you looked at them tight enough or
yeah.
at it, I don't know how to explain what kind of looking is required, but
right.
you would perceive this inner presence of this tile pattern. You know, I'm bringing it back to the human scale to try to tell you what shape it was, to try to give you some understanding. But the reality is that it had no shape, it just was. And that it perceived the identity in all things through a geometric scale, a post-Euclidean scale, as opposed to a anthropomorphic scale. I didn't have to see a face in it anymore to identify with it. I just need to see that all things that have this pattern in it.
Is it a connecting thread idea?
Yeah. It's more of like every product that's produced in the USA has a little, you know, should have like a little copyright circle on it and a little made in the USA thing on it. Well, everything that's made in the universe has this little copyright tile pattern on it, you know, and that basically says made in the universe or made in the solar system.
I see.
You know, and that's my type of perception on that.
Okay.
We're getting a little off it to go.
No, that's good. It set the mood.
You know.
So let's go to the next.
So the next thing was mixed corporate media, for which I'm going to have to refer to Bob's liner notes.
Right.
From the first CD,
CD,
where he says, mixed corporate media equals rapid succession of innovation as AirSat's anti-environment equals hologram equals Manippean satire. So therefore, I am personally led to believe that mixed corporate media, as opposed to corporate media, which seems to be the opposite, or not maybe not the opposite, but the conjugal pair to it, seems to be like there are people, like we were discussing radio personalities like Rick Dees, who go on the radio, and they're just part of the corporate media. They're not part of the mixed corporate media. They're just providing anesthetic entertainment. There's no deeper level.
What did you call him earlier? Not a...
An anesthetic?
Oh, yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
Whereas you called Bob what?
Well, Bob is not only an anesthetic, but he's also a truth injector.
Okay.
I mean, there's another level of reading to Bob where you get beyond his value as just simply anesthetic entertainment to where he becomes, you know, when one takes the time to look back and really analyze, you can find out that there is an underlying message, whereas to Rick Dees, the underlying message is that you're late to work and don't get too pissed off that you're stuck in traffic, you know.
Right.
Here's another funny song, you know. Anyhow.
So you think mixed corporate media definitely has value.
Well, I'd say what makes something a mixed corporate media is what makes it a Manippean satire. So by the same fact that Manippean satire, is, we'll discover later, has not really been super clearly defined.
Right.
Not say that it hasn't been defined or it hasn't been presented, but let's just say it hasn't been super clearly designed. And that, if we give him an identity between Manippean satire and mixed corporate media, then we basically say that any piece of corporate media that is not a Manippean satire would not be a piece of mixed corporate media.
Okay.
So then the underlying discrimination for me for what makes something mixed corporate media is if it has an essence of Manippean satire in it.
And what about the word hologram?
Well, hologram is different to me than an image. Because, see, a hologram contains the whole picture within every part. I mean, now we're talking Carl Pribram here, David Bohm, guys who were brain scientists using the holographic model for the mind, why parts of the mind can be destroyed and still retain all of its functions and stuff, because all the information is on every cell. Like, all your memory is not, like, your memory of your eighth birthday is not behind your right ear, and your memories of now are going over on the top of your head. Every cell has all the memories.
Oh, okay.
So it's like a hologram that's being imprinted on every cell. So for me, I would say that the mixed corporate media is trying to represent some kind of glimpse into the big picture, which is the grand hologram. So each small separate piece of mixed corporate media, like being like that hologram, contains the whole within itself as a part.
Is that a fractal then?
Well, I couldn't really say. I don't really have a perfect understanding of fractals, except for the idea that they go on size levels, that every little piece of a fractal is a whole fractal unto itself, and every big whole fractal is just a little piece on the edge of one.
Right. So maybe the middle.
So basically, fractals to me represent more of the as above, so below principle.
Hmm. Well, maybe mixed corporate media equaling rapid succession of innovation. Is it innovation, you think?
Or innovators.
Or innovators as AirSat's anti-environment. How do you interpret that?
Well, that's another one where the rapid succession of innovators is when we see, I mean, to me, that's like a situation where we look at like, we'll take a particular media art form, like music or television.
Okay.
Television is probably better.
Okay.
Where we have a certain anchorman, it was Walter Cronkite.
Okay.
And then a few years later, it was, I don't know who took over from Mike Wallace. And then it was so on and so forth. Then every so long, we get a different newsman.
That's a holiopathic retrieval.
Right. In a sense, not only that it's a retrieval, but also the sense that we have a succession of people who take the same job.
Okay.
And they're all fulfilling
that's same. What you're saying is the rapid succession?
Rapid succession. You know, whether Walter Cronkite's on for 20 years, 20 years in the grand scheme is a rapid succession.
Right.
But the fact they're all doing the same job, they're all presenting the same picture, they're trying to give a certain corporate view of what the news is. You know, maybe, like I said, that's not the best example, but just an idea of that succession of people performing the same job.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe hopefully the one that follows has some other new innovation. Like, in the 60s, who did we have in Vietnam? We had all kinds of, like, David Brinkley type of characters who were over in Vietnam. And they made films, and they sent them back. And then in the 70s, we had guys who would get certain satellite clearance and be able to broadcast live from foreign cities. And now it comes forward till we get the Iraq War, to where we got a guy standing there with a radar dish and Pete Arnett standing next to him broadcasting live up on the satellite from anywhere at any time. And that's certainly an innovation over the journalistic techniques of the guys in the Vietnam War and the guys in the 70s and early 80s.
Though it's in the same format, exactly. It has been innovative.
It's an innovation. And so if somebody was successfully, and as I will use Pete Arnett as an example, if someone successfully communicating or attempting to communicate an undercurrent message, which is there all the time, over in the visual obvious, I mean, that to me is the example of an ersatz anti-environment. Like when Peter Arnett is bound by censorship laws not to say, oh yeah, and they bombed such and such, and that he would give a clue to his colleague Bernard Shaw, I started to pick up on this, that he would go, well, Bernie, and whenever he would say the person's name or the person's name who was bragging, that was basically communicating that he wasn't telling you all he could say.
Oh.
You know, he would say, well, a lot of bombs have been dropped today. Nothing real specific has been hit, Bernie. And that means that something's been hit and he couldn't talk about it. You know, so even though he's still performing his obvious corporate job as just being a reporter, for those of us who were hip enough to figure out what the hell this whole kept saying the person's first name thing was about, we were able to realize there was an undercurrent of knowledge and information being transmitted. And that is the same thing that other people had done in earlier mediums indirectly, where people had produced their own documentaries on subjects that had been covered by the news, where people had, you know. Anyhow, the idea of the ersatz anti-environment is also when somebody basically hijacks the media. You know, someone...
like Howard or Rush?
Well, yeah, but more directly in the form of... I'll just use Bob, for example. When Bob comes on the radio, he becomes another entertaining radio personality.
Right.
However, where he differs from those people is that he's... not only participating in his medium or that particular medium, he's also criticizing it and developing an understanding of it that these other guys are doing. When I'm telling you the news, just reading you the news, I'm basically advertising other forms of media. You know, if I'm telling you about sports, I'm trying to sell. I'm selling sports. I'm selling
all advertising advertises advertising.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but when Bob's on there and he's not only advertising, because he's advertising his own stuff by being, but on another level, he's also putting out information that allows the listener to comprehend media or a bigger picture than just the entertainment at hand. You know, essentially, we could maybe say that an ersatz anti-environment goes when there's a certain intention of communicating the limitations of the form of the media.
That's what Manipian satire is, I think.
Well, I think a Manipian satire also contains the idea of, you know, playing out... Well, I'll give you a classic example of what I consider a Manipian satire. Morton Downey Jr.
Right.
Used to have a television show on.
Right.
And he would pick some topic, a hot topic always, boring topic. Not just some, like, sensational topic like... you know, Geraldo picks women who right. were beat by men regularly, you know.
Right.
And he would bring on the most informed persons from the left and the most informed persons of the right, a la Phil Donahue.
Right.
Okay. And he would let them present their case like Phil Donahue, and then he would proceed to pick at their case what he didn't like. And he wouldn't just pick at the left and not pick at the right. He would pick at both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is where he differs from Donahue and why I see it as a Manipian satire. Donahue brings on the same people. He eats apart the left. He eats apart the right. Then he gives you Donahue's opinion. And you're supposed to identify with Donahue. You're supposed to think he's sane. He's middle ground. And you eat his pre-digested Donahue opinion, and you say, Donahue's a sensible guy, and he showed me the limitations of either argument, so I feel like Donahue feels. So basically, Donahue gives the public their opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So when I say media fast, cut yourself away from Donahue, okay?
Right.
He's a great guy, he means well, but he's giving people a lot of pre-digested attitudes and opinions.
Right.
Morton Downey, on the other hand, would cut apart the left and cut apart the right, and then discredit himself in the process, make so many stupid jokes, he would discredit himself as an intellectual and force you as the audience or as the watcher to make up your own mind.
Uh-huh.
Because he's shown you the faults of the left's argument, he's shown you the faults of the right's argument, and he's not giving you an opinion in the middle that you can say is sensible. He discredits himself, and you are forced to make up your own mind. So Morton Downey Jr. was a smart guy, or his producer was, and they knew that that was what this was doing.
Right.
They were not trying to just... that. So on a level that he knows that he's causing people to make up their own mind about certain key issues, it's a Menippean satire. He's satirizing the talk show host, the whole format of debate. He's satirizing all those things on the television. But on another level, he's doing it straight. Another level, he's just actually just doing it like any other show. But on another level, he's satirizing it because he realizes that the type of person that he is and the personality that he's portraying, not necessarily that he necessarily really is, but that he's portraying,
right,
is satirizing these know-it-all, sensible, middle-of-the-road, talk show host type guys. He's satirizing that. And so he's forcing them. So to me, that's a good example of the Menippean satire, I mean, as I perceive it.
Right. And does that person have to be aware of what they're doing? Does Mort have to be aware of what he's doing in order to do that?
Somebody has to be aware, whether it's
either
Mort
or
his
producer.
Somebody who's involved in the structure and in the content, not only the form or the figure, but both, you know, both of them, has to know, has to realize. You know, it doesn't really matter if Mort's an asshole and he doesn't realize.
Right.
You know, somebody will realize. Even if nobody actually, it's really all satire in terms of what I think what makes it is what the audience can get out of it. I mean, maybe it doesn't matter whether Mort or his producer know, if I can get that out of it. You know, whereas I can't get that out of Donahue, because Donahue does not do that. Donahue gives you his middle-of-the-road opinion, and it's presented in a way to where there's not an undercurrent of think for yourself. Which is the undercurrent of the Morton Downey show, is think for yourself. The undercurrent of Phil Donahue's show is, and this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Take it or leave it, you know?
So what's the AirSat's anti-environment in the Mort Downey?
So the AirSat's anti-environment is that they seem to be just doing a normal another talk show. Whereas at the same time, that's only temporary, you know? The idea of think for yourself is represented in numbers of mediums, and you'd have to use different, like if you wanted to have a think for yourself talk show, you'd have Bob on the radio. If you want to have a think for yourself talk show on the TV, you have that. If you want to have a think for yourself type of book, you write Marshall McLuhan's The Medium is the Massage, because you can't just look through that book and just say, oh, you know, it's a piece of, like a normal book. I read it through from cover to cover and read the story, and June falls in love with Bobby and they have kids. It's not like that at all. You have to, it's somewhat disjointed, and you're forced to take your own, you know, the message for me at Media Massage is think for yourself about media.
Yeah.
Don't take pre-digested attitudes about media. You know, that's why kind of the idea of the book, Understanding Media, you know, is a Menippean satire.
That's good.
Anyhow,
I think you've got it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I have an idea of what it is. I just think that it's not... I've really only developed that idea by hammering you, Jerry, to try to get you to give me as much information as you could about it. It really, from the material that I've had to study, I really could not clearly out of. I looked the book up. I looked the word Menippean up in about four different dictionaries, and it didn't appear.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I went, oh, well... You know, fortunately, you showed me the literary anthology book that had the term. It gave me somewhat of an idea. But I think, you know, directly, so what, we go back to mixed corporate media. A mixed corporate media is a creation or presentation of an an AirSat's anti-environment.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's a hologram because it's a piece, but it contains the whole inside of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the Menippean satire. So, I mean, so to me, basically a mixed corporate media is a mix between straight corporate and anti-corporate.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe to put it in another term that I got of it, we could say that mixed corporate media is the is big A art with a small A point, maybe.
That might be a good way to say it. And yeah, we'll get into capital A and small A art. Right. But it's funny how you naturally flowed into the rest of the sentence, because I'll say the sentence again. I say human scale is a reflex reaction to the situation we've come to in our mixed corporate media effects. And I don't have identification with anything that's going on. I offer the technique of suspended judgment, which you just touched on at the end of that.
Yeah. You know, that leads into the next thing, which I personally have highlighted, and I think is the next few sentences is really the most clear and concise statement of what I perceive as Bob's point, which is no point of view.
Right.
Which, as opposed to the anthropomorphic scale or a solar scale, to go to a transcendental universal scale, where you study the effects and not just, and instead of saying, I don't study the content, maybe it should say, I don't study just the content.
Right.
You recognize the content, but you don't become obsessed with it or think that the content is all there is. He studies the ground. I study the ground, quote, the effects of media on people. You've got to have the technique of suspended judgment and get out of the sensory bias of your time. And that, to me, is the point. It seems to be the point of the whole media fast, media ecology thing is so that you get out of your sensory bias by limiting your sensory input, you know, by consciously trying to construct what your sensory input is, what you associate with, you know, instead of, you know, once again, like I said, stop watching Donahue and getting a pre-digested attitude. You have an opinion on gun control that deep down in you somewhere inside. You don't need Donahue to give it to you. You know, you don't even need the media to give it to you.
Right.
If you actually think about it, you know, you either think people should have guns or shouldn't have guns.
Right.
You know? Whether or not you personally want to have one, personally, that doesn't mean whether or not you realize that other people should have the right to or whatever have them. Like, I personally don't want to carry a gun around.
Right.
But I definitely think there's a need for people in the private sector to have guns.
Right.
You know? So that's not like because Phil Donahue told me.
Right.
But that's because that's how I feel. And I know that away from all the sensory bias and away from all the media input. Because I've experienced that. You know? There's various other things, you know. It's like the idea of being able to, like, suspend a judgment to me means the idea of being able to not participate or not desire something and yet not condemning someone for feeling the same way you do. Like, you know, if somebody wants to smoke cigarettes and I don't want to smoke cigarettes, it'd be useless for me to pass judgment on them and think they're a lesser person because they want to smoke cigarettes. Hmm. However, a suspended judgment would be to say, well, they're going to do what they got to do, you know. Not to say that cigarettes are good or that cigarettes are bad. Either way, just to say that that's what they're going to do. You know. Anyhow, I think that that's the big point of overall. Whether or not that's the big point here in entertainment sucks. I think that seems to be the big point overall.
Well, that's exactly what I did. I pulled that paragraph, that brief excerpt from Bob's radio show, just as an intro to give people a little idea of who they were about to experience. Right. I just pulled that. That was my random, you know, little.
No, that's good.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, look, there's a certain order in just that whole thing that starts with I say human scale and ends with sensory bias of your time. There's a whole order of things that need to be explained. Obviously, you need to understand what human scale is. Then you need to understand what mixed corporate media is. And then when you understand that and you understand suspended judgment, then we get down to where we have to go understanding the next term, which is ground.
Right.
Which I'm sure McLuhan gives a really good definition of. Bob really doesn't need to define, I'm sure, McLuhan.
Well, that it's hard. I've never figured out figuring ground as well as I want to. But if the ground is medicine, then Connie's the figure as a doctor. If the ground is the landscape, then the tree is the figure. But I know it's more than that. That's the typical psychology definition of figure ground.
Well, I think more specifically, if we have a sentence of words that's made out of a subject and a predicate,
right,
that the subject is the figure, on one level.
And the ground is
and the ground is the and the predicate, the verb action is the ground on another level. When I write a sentence, I say, Jerry goes shopping. On one level, Jerry, the subject, is the figure, and shopping, going shopping, is the ground. But on another level, Jerry goes shopping, the whole thing is merely a figure of speech, and speech is the ground, you know, or of language.
That's good.
So, I mean, figure and ground is as above, so below, microcosm, macrocosm type of relationship between concepts and images.
Mm-hmm.
But what seems to be the ground is seems to be a reflection of what overall intention or body of knowledge or subject is this particular image or whatever directed towards. Enlightening or uncovering, which enlightening, uncovering, and accelerating being my definitions for hoik. So essentially.
So you say that again. You think the verb hoik
is to, like, basically, for my perception, is to uncover, to enlighten, or to present, and accelerate.
Oh, okay.
So a figure hoiks up a ground, whatever specific thing we're hoiking up is reflecting or presenting or examining or accelerating a certain condition or other subject. Okay?
All right.
So, but at some, like, level, once we find out what that ground becomes a figure in another ground.
Yeah.
Until we get to the actual no ground situation, you know, it's kind of like I thought that opposites, I wrote in my book, opposites are merely two ends of a stick. And the trick is to figure out where you're holding the stick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we take something and we put its opposite, like we could take light and dark, like bright and dark, let's say, and dark. And we could say that those are two ends of a stick.
Right.
But what do we call the stick? Now, what we might call the stick is perception or you know, some other term. Well, that stick, perception, has an opposite too. So that stick is merely the end of another stick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, ultimately, the sticks get bigger until we get to this one big stick, you know, of which all these opposites reduce to. And that, to me, is that central ground. That is the ground. And that, mm-hmm. you know, I'd be hard-pressed to try to say what I thought that the original stick was.
The redwood is.
Yeah. But just more in the sense of that when you start basically reducing things to a level, it comes to a point where you get opposites that are different. But then it gets to the point where you have an opposite that's just is or isn't, like A or not A, or X or not X.
Yeah.
You know, like light and dark is not dark and not dark. See? Mm-hmm. That's not X and not X. That's mm-hmm. that's actually a actual dichotomy. So we take perception. Well, what would be the opposite of perception? I mean, I could give a simple one and say no perception. That's the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
Or I could say ignorance. Mm-hmm. So perception and ignorance are another opposite. Now, what's the thing that unifies ignorance and perception? Knowledge,
mm-hmm.
right? Because you either perceive the knowledge or you're ignorant of
mm-hmm.
it. So then what's knowledge the opposite of? See? And so on and so forth. Then you take this stick in, so you find that will give you the ground. So ultimately, you'll find out that, like, perception is standing on the ground of knowledge, and knowledge is standing on the ground of, and so on, until you finally get to a level where it gets to, basically, it seems ultimately to always get to isness and not isness. Basically, what is and what is not.
Mm-hmm.
Which we discover is all an illusion. So this ultimate ground doesn't really exist, you know, and that seems to concur with what Bob says.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, ground is merely the illusion of continuity, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe Bob could correct me, but it seems to me that when we talk about ground, we're talking about the illusion of continuity. Now, when we talk about maybe the ultimate ground or the final ground or the original ground, I mean, the beginning and the end being
mm-hmm.
the same, if you take that stick and bend it till it becomes like a chain link,
mm-hmm.
you know, you can fuse the two ends together and you get a circle, and then there's no beginning, no end. There just is isness.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, you're on the bus or you're not on the bus. Mm-hmm. You know, whether you're in the front or the back mm-hmm. doesn't matter.
Let me just ask you, if this is like Larry Silk often asks the question, is human progress cyclical or cumulative? So he wants to know, you know, is it going up or is it going around and around? And so before I continue the point,
we'll pause.
We'll pause briefly. And this is Contemporary Communications Conference with Jerry Fielka and Mark Free discussing Bob Dogma. Well, welcome back to Contemporary Communications Conference, and we're discussing Bob Dogma. And I was going to continue this point momentarily with Mark Free about human progress being cyclical or cumulative. And Bob actually says that it's a spiral.
I agree
with
that.
So that's what you were just talking about. Is a spiral motion.
I enthusiastically agree with that because whereas the progression of consciousness appears from one perspective to be purely cyclical, if we were to take a slinky and set it on the ground, a slinky which we happen to know is a spiral, a spring, and set it on the ground and look down on it, at a certain point of height, the depth of the slinky will fall away and it will merely appear to be a circle. And if we attached a small little diode to travel around the slinky, it would appear only to go around in circles as it was going up and down the slinky. So really, it's a spiral motion, but appears cyclically only due to a matter of perspective. You know, like I said, if you're looking down on the spiral, it just seems to be going in a circle. But if you're looking from the side, it seems to be moving up or down. Now, then up or down, it depends on being another type of thing. Is it up or is it down? And I think that's another perspective bias.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say that it is moving, and let's say that it is growing, and I would say in a cyclical yet spiral nature at the same time. Certainly, it doesn't seem to be a cumulative thing because life does not seem to be an amassing of stuff, so to speak. I've obviously seen that the interpretation of life as being an accrual of stuff has led to very full garbage dumps. But more directly, I think we can say that it's trying to purify and consecrate this quote unquote stuff, and that seems to progress through an intelligible order of events that create a progression to where if something becomes purer and purer and purer and more consecrated, so to speak. If I start with a raw lump of gold and I smelted it, I would get a 14 karat product, and then I would smelt it out a little more and try to get stuff out of it. I could maybe get to 18 and go through the same cycle again. And every time it's the same cycle to smelt it. It's the same melting it down. It's the same hammering it out. Each time ending up with a slightly more pure progress. So even though it's the same process, the same circular cyclical process, in the overall scheme of things, it's an upward spiral progression through the same cycle higher and higher until we finally end up with this pure 24 karat gold ingot that started off as a raw ore lump.
Mm-hmm.
See, so in a sense, it follows a intelligible cyclic pattern, which someone might falsely, due to perspective, interpret as being end all be all, this cycle. But that cycle is producing a purified and consecrated product that defies the limits of just a banal cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know whether I've answered your question.
Well, that was good. You pulled in the idea, and it brought to mind McLuhan saying, support your local junkyard, throw away something beautiful today.
Sure, sure. One man's trash is another man's treasure.
Okay, and let's talk, since we're talking about trash and treasure.
One man's girlfriend is another man's piece of shit.
So let's touch on a word that we didn't touch on yet and has been suggested by our dear engineer, Jeff Davison, who's from the real world. That's R-E-E-L.
I suppose those of us in the abstract discarnate state.
Right. Is the word entertainment.
Boy, that's a tough word, Jerry.
Yeah.
It seems to be, obviously, with the title of the thing being Entertainment Sucks, I think think Bob is would I probably prefer that in purpose of this discussion, do we mean to discuss entertainment as what is entertainment, or what is entertaining, or do we need to say what does Bob mean as entertainment in entertainment sucks? Is it, which of those would be
the third one?
The last one. We want to touch on what we perceive to be Bob's meaning of entertainment. Well, it seems to me from the clearly banal point of view that if he says entertainment sucks, then it's obviously not a manipulative satire. So any form of any product of media, which is not a manipulative satire, which also by weird mathematical identity would make it any piece of corporate media,
right,
is entertainment. Any piece of corporate media that isn't mixed corporate media. Any piece of work that is not a manipulative satire. Any piece of work that is not a hologram. Any piece of work that's produced not in an anti-environment is therefore entertainment. I mean, that's just working with the mathematical identities he lies forth. So maybe we could say that what makes something entertainment is merely something that's an anesthetic, a distraction, a painkiller, not without any really beneficial in terms of the transmutation of the essence of the not only the listener but the subject, isn't fulfilled by this entertainment. When Bob comes on the air and makes you laugh because what he says is funny, it's entertainment just as if Buddy Hackett is telling dirty jokes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But the undercurrent that's contained within Bob's message that can be taken out of it can probably not be taken out of Buddy Hackett's routine. So Buddy Hackett stuff is just merely a distraction, something to occupy our attention to make us, you know, it may open us up, it may allow us to learn things, but on a most banal of levels, on a most basic level,
right,
it's just purely taking up space with content,
right,
and not progressing, you know. So I would basically define, I would say entertainment for me, and this may be outside of Bob, is to say that something that's just purely entertainment is something that's just purely distracting. Something that's educational or informative can also be entertaining, or you can entertain those forms, but on some level they can train holographic or even manipulative satire levels. I don't know if we've clearly defined that enough for Jeff, but
I think that,
you know,
was
I think
good.
That's pretty close, you know, and you know, I think what Bob seems to be saying is entertainment that sucks is people who think that they're out there doing this big service to humanity when all they're really doing is numbing them out. And I think those are the people he's really saying who suck in entertainment.
Right.
People who are just sucking off the consciousness, who are just bringing everybody down or tuning them out, so to speak, or tuning them off. You know, I think that's the gist of what Bob is saying as entertainment sucks. You know, I don't think he's saying anybody who wants to perform. I don't think he's saying performers suck. I don't think he's saying composers suck. I think he's drawing a line on the intention of the media that's being presented, and, you know,
okay,
say whether it's shallow or not.
So now, Mark, what term did you want to move to?
All right, now that we've finally got out of the introduction after an hour, that's how much meaning we pack into every sentence. Anyhow, we go down and we get into the first statement, second statement. Okay, third Bob, page one, third Bob. Because of the electric environment, since the telegraph is essentially tactile and interplays all the sensory faculties, hence various cultures need to hoik up their own cultural preference. Now, hoik is obviously the next specialized term.
Mm-hmm.
We've already pretty much given a good definition for that as I see it as being uncovering, maybe we want to use retrieving as well, uncovering, retrieving, or expanding or accelerating as the term I prefer, you know. That goes on. Hence, various scholars need to hoik up their own cultural preference as a fashionable response and sensory closure to life at the speed of light. This sensory closure is a big topic in itself.
And how do you define that?
Well, sensory closure seems to be the field of limited awareness that we work within. I mean, you are when something happens in your environment, you interpret it through your senses, and your senses have certain limits to what you'll perceive something as. You know, in terms of color, you know, a light may flash through the room and it may be red. It was a flash of red light to you because that's what your sensory closure is. Now, to someone who's more open-minded, say, you know, cosmic awareness or Aleister Crowley or Edgar Cayce, maybe it was a disincarnate spirit that shot through the room.
Mm.
But to you, your sensory closure said that it had to be a red flash of light.
Is it just bias then?
Well, yeah.
Sensory bias?
Well, but it's not only bias, but it's a limitation. It's not just bias in the sense of, like, what you'll accept, which is what bias basically seems to imply, you know, what you're willing to believe or whatever. But this idea of sensory closure seems to be the idea of what you're actually able to perceive, not accept, but just actually just on a raw level of receiving.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some people's sensory closure is probably such that they think that there's nothing to be learned through their sense of touch, or there's nothing to be learned, you know, through smell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe those senses are closed off to them as far as inputs of knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe because their nose has been removed, or they have no fingers, but also maybe on another level because they just don't think that they aren't able to perceive a flow of information through those senses.
Uh-huh.
You know, whereas there are, you know, certainly other animals that have no sense of speech or sense of vision per se. I mean, or develop vision, and they are able to perceive and function within their environment purely through their sense of smell and their sense of touch.
Uh-huh.
You know, so I mean, I think when we discuss this whole quote of that one, which turns into a huge quote, I might add, that we get to sensory closure to, he makes it specific, to life at the speed of light. Okay? Which means that you might have sensory closure to the fact that these words that we're taping right now are not going to get to Bob when the tape gets to him, that they're getting to him right now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But there's a certain sensory closure. Now, Bob doesn't have that sensory closure, so that concept will not seem alien to him. Mm-hmm. It will not be incomprehensible. It will be understandable.
That he's actually hearing them right now?
That on some level, on an interior telephonic transmitting, telepathic,
right,
clairvoyant maybe even level.
Complex clairvoyance.
Yes, he's perceiving this just as we're maybe perceiving that he's having a cup of coffee right now.
Right.
Okay.
He doesn't drink coffee.
Well, whatever.
He's drinking juice.
He's having something to drink. I was gonna say. I just pulled that out. I mean, maybe Bob, if you remember today, 3:08 on Wednesday,
February 16th,
maybe you can check it. Whether at 3:08 PST you were having a drink. That'll be how weird it is. But anyhow.
Very good, by the way, Mark. That is definitely what Bob is all about.
But, I mean,
complex clairvoyant.
So, what we're discussing here about sensory closure, you know, is merely a term that needs to be expanded in the sense of saying is either a collective preference that's being stated, or a cultural bias, or maybe even just a personal bias. I mean, who knows, you know? Maybe people who came out of the womb into a room that was bright and some guy spanked them on the butt and their first experience was pain and bright light are not too fond of the idea of salvation coming in the form of bright light to them. You know? On some deep level, all it means to them is I'm going to get spanked on my butt.
Right.
You know, but to somebody else who didn't have that experience, maybe they don't have sensory closure to the idea of the vanishing point being a big doorway of light that you go through after which there's no light.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, I think that's obviously what the Christian mythos of the going into the light thing is obviously at some point you've transcended your body and now you're going to transcend illumination by going through the vanishing point. You know,
mm-hmm.
Whether you could do it. See, it seems to me like that happens to everybody when they die. You know, everybody becomes aware, big A aware.
Uh-huh.
The trick is to do it in this form, in this body, in this here and now, so that you can get out of this endless cycle of creation and destruction and just be creation.
Is that Zen Buddhism?
Well, no, I don't think it's Zen Buddhism. I think that's the interior mystery tradition of life.
That's the interior landscape?
Well, I don't know if it's the interior landscape, but it's the interior function, I think, behind all the mystery schools, Eastern and Western. I think that's basically, you know, what they tell you is that, you know, we all attain to a certain degree of cosmic consciousness at death or at birth, and that we limit that cosmic consciousness in order to become functional individuals. Well, there's a point where, as a functional individual, these mystery schools teach you where you are able to not only retain that functionality as an individual, but also to perceive cosmic consciousness. And the way to do that is to get out of all your sensory closures and your sensory biases. Now, I say those as separate, because there's points where they are closed to you, and there are points where they are just merely being avoided or not noticed due to bias.
Mm.
Like, bias is in terms to me of you know, not wanting, related to a desire nature, whereas closure, you know, is more related to a position,
mm-hmm.
In terms of where you are on the ground.
Is this sensory closure close to ESP?
Is it close to ESP?
Or what people think of ESP?
No, I think it's a matter of which doors of perception you have open. If you have all the doors open, you know, all your senses giving you the information, that's not sensory closure. Sensory closure to me is when you're only trickling through certain doors, or certain doors are part open, or certain doors are all the way open and certain ones are closed. And I mean, I think we're not really touched on it. I haven't found it in here, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere, is the concept that not only do you have these externalized senses of sight and hearing and touch and smell and taste, but you have interior corresponds to that. I mean, I can hear you talk,
mm-hmm.
okay? But at the same time, there's an interior hearing inside of me that can hear my thoughts.
Right.
Which is the same hearing that if I want to hear what Bob is thinking right now, I'd have to use that hearing and not my outward directed hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if I had the door of my inner hearing all the way open, I could hear whatever I wanted to hear. Now, it might get really distracting. So, I mean, a certain degree of sensory closure is necessary, like I said, to maintain things as a functioning individual,
mm-hmm.
as a separate entity. And, you know, the separateness is important.
Mm-hmm.
So to be able to work with that sensory closure where it becomes a temporary anti-environment, where it's temporary, where those closures where you're opening and shutting the doors, because at different times you need to have different doors open and shut,
mm-hmm.
of perception, that is, that these doors I'm referring to.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to sensory closure where maybe it's not just closure, it's like sensory wall building, you know, in the sense that, you know, those doors just won't open or can't be open or can't be reached. You know, people have built up a wall in front of the door so they can't even open it,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it won't be until the swell of information dying to get through to you through those senses gets so strong that it can knock that wall down, really, quote unquote, rock your world, that you might perceive that, you know. You know, it's like a lot of people would probably say to you, I've never gained any knowledge through my sense of touch. You know, I mean, in a direct form, they never really learned how to talk through their sense of touch. Maybe they think that. I'm not going to say whether they did or didn't.
Right.
But let's just say most of them have probably learned something about the way life works through their dick. You know,
mm-hmm.
and that was definitely the sense of touch. So it's all a matter of what level you're willing to perceive it. You know,
right? They think touch is solely your fingers.
Solely your fingers, yeah. Or you know, and what we end up discovering in the end is that all of your senses are basically consumed within the sense of touch. Your eyes are touching what they look at. Your ears are touching what they're listening to, or you're being touched by it.
That's
which takes me to what I wanted to say about the electric environment and what seems to be the electric environment as a retrieval of the acoustic environment.
Okay.
I mean, in the sense that, you know, we're saying the electric environment is tactile. It's based on touch. Well, the acoustic environment is also tactile. A deaf person who sits at a piano and puts their hand on the piano can feel the thing. And you can feel with your hand the difference between a minor chord and a major chord.
Mm-hmm.
And what you can feel is there's more vibrational dissonance beats as they are inside of a more dissonant minor chord. You can feel it as opposed to the major chord. So now when we go to the electric space and we say that it's similar to acoustic space in that you can feel the acoustic thing. So the electric space retrieving the acoustical space is like it. However, sound travels at 637 whatever miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And electricity moves at C, at the speed of light, which it's irrelevant to say what it is. I know what it is.
Yeah.
It's basically 3.0 times 10 to the 10th centimeters per second, or if you want 3.0 times 10 to the 8 meters per second. But
it's a lot faster.
It's a lot faster. I mean, it's not even, you know, one order of magnitude different in speed. We're talking about an order of magnitude of tens of ten, you know, 10 to the 10th here, essentially.
Mm.
You know, so when Bob says that we are seeking various cultures need to wake up their own cultural preference as a fashionable response and sensory closure to life at the speed of light, he, you know, what we're saying there is that we're having to come to grips with the fact that this is a retrieval and that we have memories that are related to this kind of state. But at the same time, it's going so much faster that we have to speed up to catch up with ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
The rearview mirror effect. So anyhow, to go on to what he discusses, we're going on and we look through and we're not really having anything until we get to the bottom, middle of page two. Well, we go heliotropical, no time of electrical tactility. Or to put it in parentheses, he says, if you work in these 20th century crafts, I think he's referring to the media environment, you are servicing the need of people's fashionable sensory closure as a recovery from the obliteration by the heliotropical no time of electric tactility. Well, heliotropical. Well, helio, sun, and tropical. See, I can't really say what he's, you know, directly trying to say here, but I think what I can infer is that he's talking about that the post-1945 state, where we are on the same spot, where we're in the same time, where time really hasn't changed, where nothing is new and nothing is old, that is basically what I'm perceiving as the heliotropical state. Now, Bob can correct us.
Nothing is old under the sun.
And nothing is new either.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the heliotropical no time of electric tactility. However, that is not instantly clear to the person who just reads through. So maybe there's another word we can use instead of that, or maybe there isn't, so on and so forth. He goes on to discuss people who are what society generally receives as artists. And he goes on to say that they're communicating to the audience who basically needs content for the electric media as a balm, an aesthetic massage to nullify the awareness of tactility, i.e., in my terms, an anesthetic.
Mm-hmm.
So
a painkiller.
A painkiller, yeah. So, I mean, he seems to lay out this whole part of here that people, and he says correctly, artists are making sensory anesthetics in music and movies and in arts and theater and dance. And so he says that the other theaters are basically occupying your attention, and by occupying, they're not only filling it, but they're numbing it. Because you haven't got, when they're making you read about Nirvana, you're not reading about Bob. And when you're not reading about Bob, anyhow,
I thought Bob and Nirvana were the same thing.
They are. I'm just saying, but you have to go down through so many more levels of figure and ground and satire to get to the same point. See, I think that's where we're talking about, you know, clarity. And that's why, you know, it's so important, you know, because most people would not want to take the time to find the message in Nirvana, which is probably a very good example of holographic mixed corporate media.
Right.
But most people would not want to take the time. They'd be just content to use it as an anesthetic.
Right.
It's like most people are probably content to use cocaine as a recreational anesthetic and don't want to use it to get a root canal. You know. So anyhow, to keep going, looking down, we're just looking through the page, see if there's anything else. And this, we're still on page two here. And I think we get to the collective unconscious needs. mass mind as the collective conscious needs. Now, mass mind. And he basically seems to define this as the simultaneous communication of events that happens at the speed of light between all living creatures.
Mm-hmm.
So, I will say that that's somewhat defined by inference, again, much as heliotropical no-time electric tactility was defined. You know, so we go on, and we go to the whole Warhol famous for and famous in 15 minutes section,
mm-hmm.
where he puts forth his aphorism that the audience is the elusive opiate of the people.
Yeah.
Which, to me, is the point of the whole first couple sections.
Mm-hmm.
Basically,
when you define the audience is the elusive opiate of the peoples,
right.
plural, as what?
Well, let's take it apart first. Audience, we know what an audience is. Audience is the person to whom the media is being directed or received by. And the illusion. But now, opiate. Well, what are opiates? You know, opiates are pain-killing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they're addictive. So we could say that, say the audience is the elusive opiate of the peoples, is basically, he's saying that the illusion of separateness as a reflection of separateness merely based on visual bias,
mm-hmm.
is what people seek to maintain by using the opiates of media that are out there. Like, instead of just going, I'm a life form, I am being pushed by my participation as an audience to become a demographic figure where I then become a white male in a certain age group of a certain creed and a certain, you know, various demographic factors.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas those are all illusions.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my body may very well be that of what we typify as a white male. But on another level, I am not my body. But however, this anesthetic of media without the deeper level of content, as opposed to just the superficial appearance of content, will never make me realize that I am not my body. The media will perpetually tell me that I am my body and I need these things to hang on my body and I want to make my body a certain way. And if I don't make my body a certain way, I'm going to get pain or I'm going to get pleasure. And that's what they try to portray to me.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, maybe that is the elusive opiate, is that people don't, you know, it's probably easier to go on through life, or, you know, I wouldn't say it's simpler, but let's just say it's easier to go on being ignorant or to accept that my body is all I am when that's not true.
It's easier to be a zombie.
Yeah, it's easier to be a zombie. I mean, there's no thinking involved if you're not thinking, you know. What does my old girlfriend say? No brain, no headache, you know. So, you have to look at it within that type of framework. I think that's what he's basically saying in the first part, the first page or two. Basically seems to be pushing the concept that the audience is the elusive opiate of the people, and the subtext of that being anyone who is hung up in the content of any of specific media and thinks that they're transmitting the message through that is deluded or being deluded. So he goes down to discuss a more proper relationship, where after he basically discussed that no one's listening to anybody, and that he says that, now we're over on page 4, he says that the actual fact is that other media are only using you as content for their media. He gives an example of a magazine and the different features in that being parts of representations, advertising, other forms of media. So he then discussed the sender-receiver syndrome, which is the next specialized point, which is basically the sender-receiver syndrome is basically a good title to discuss the fact that the audience really isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
That you think you're sending it to somebody who's going to receive it, but the fact of the matter is that they are you, and you're not sending it anywhere. So, to which we get down to a word which I know is in the dictionary, which I didn't look up yet, or I should have looked up, which is solipsism. Maybe Jerry, you can give me a quick sketch of that word?
I can look it up for you real fast.
Okay.
What do you think it means?
I couldn't really honestly say. Yes, I haven't done my homework. To say that where it seems to go after this is that if a person doesn't fall into this solipsism, which seems to me to be a certain kind of probably contentedness about oneself, I would guess, they don't understand the dynamic, they fill a vacuum and try to fill it up with the appropriate drug for living at the speed of light, which would be heroin, an opiate, or any kind of fast speed drug. So for some people, it might be CNN, you know. And here we get the definition of solipsism. The doctrine that since all knowledge is subjective, the self is the only entity directly known. Right, that all that I am is all that there is, and that's all that matters. You know, that all that I know about Mark is all the knowledge there is in the universe as far as I'm concerned. I guess that would be a solipsism. Right, so essentially, self-indulgent on some level. So, you know, not to cut Frank, but we're saying Frank was a little self-indulgent, you know, because he didn't go off into the vacuum, which is probably the right thing to do.
Well, I don't know if there's a right or a wrong.
It's no, just there isn't. Just isness and yeah. Is notness. And so then we go down trying to discuss the use of the artist. The next couple sections seems to be, you know, just thinking about that, what the purpose of the artist is, or the person as of the purpose of the person who we generally perceive to be the artist is, because we're going to discuss later that there are no artists. When it says that artists think they are the antennae of the race and they remain the antennae race, then they think there is a race to communicate for or to improve, you know, purifying the dialect of the tribe, the speech of the tribe. So if they have that anthropomorphic illusion that they are updating avant-garde needs of the race, they haven't even begun to see that in the 20th century, in the global theater, the only actors and the only spectators are the other media. That right there is the gist of that whole section, saying that artists not perceiving the sender-receiver syndrome, not realizing that, perceive themselves to be communicators, but not knowing what it is that they're communicating or how they're actually communicating, they're not fulfilling that thing. He goes on later to to say that the media as entities of themselves are attached with these people to their work. I mean, I'm kind of getting ahead here myself. But basically, we go back and say that the global theater and the actors and everything, your perception of this relationship between the artist and his audience, if it isn't grounded or based upon the concept of ground, is merely an illusion of a self-indulgent illusion of the artist. So even though there may be some actual value to a lot of this quote-unquote solipsism or self-indulgent art or whatever, even though there may actually be truthful content to it, the artist in himself thinking that his is the end-all be-all or whatever is an illusion and not based on, because he's trapped within his single form of media. That's why, you know, it's hard to say that there are many artists or true artists, because most of them deal specifically are specialists, and they're specialists in one medium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like Frank Zappa. He specialized in music, and he got very good at it.
Mm-hmm.
And he took it probably as far as anyone has taken it.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't he didn't really touch into the print medium. He has a book,
mm-hmm.
which he wrote with somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
He had help. He got a specialist who was a print specialist to help him. And he's made some other video, some video stuff, and mm-hmm. some other. But his real value.
Well, his specialty was entertainment.
Right, but his value in the overall picture is seen by the transcendental points that he presents, not only in his music, or not only in his book, or not only on his videos, but the points that run through all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Those things seem to be actually what the content of his work is, as opposed to the specific content of whatever the piece is. If you follow.
Oh, that's called conceptual continuity.
Right.
Right.
So.
The thread that.
You know, which Bob doesn't touch on in here, to basically saying that if an artist doesn't have some kind of idea of multimedia conceptual continuity, that they're deluding themselves into pretending they're an artist. Basically, they're masturbating and thinking they're having, you know, interaction, you know. They're making love with a blow-up doll that they think is animated. I don't know. So then we seem to get into the next part of thing where he discusses the media. You know, he seems to talk about the non-existence of the actual world we're living in.
Well, that one good line, I think, is, then you have to tell them that the media is so much us that they've taken over the anthropomorphic scale because people don't know that they wear these new lungs, these new organs, these new environments as their new bodies.
Okay.
They don't know they're us.
So you have to make them aware of media as entities in themselves.
Right.
And once you make them aware of these entities, then you reattach the media to the person's body.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, my fingers can dial the phone or turn on the TV and flip the channels. And so I'm directly connected to these things. However, within my limited normal, or let's not use normal, but standard anthropomorphic scale, because those things are not physically on my body all the time, with the exception of maybe a cellular telephone would maybe be transcending that,
mm-hmm.
people would think of that as being a television as being a separate entity from themselves, or mm-hmm. a telephone as being separate from themselves. You know, I think what Bob is trying to say here is that when you realize how that you have the power of knowing how to use a telephone to reach anywhere you have the number for, you're directly connected to that place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if I can call Fiji, I'm touching Fiji.
Because
mm-hmm. we decided that anything using electric environment is tactile. I'm touching it.
Yeah.
And anything I can touch is in my direct environment, I'm a lot more likely to be able to transcendentally identify with myself. Like, when you look at, quote-unquote, your things, it's easier to identify with them as being products of humanity or of your creation as it is to just look at a pile of stuff out in the alley behind somebody else's house and say that, you know, I'm those things or those are my things,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, being hung up in this concept of identity or where the limits of your being end.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like I said, that seems to be what the actual overall just being, going back to the statement in the prologue, is like, where is the limits of your beingness?
Mm-hmm.
And we are constantly being bombarded by the media that said that the beingness ends at our body. It ends at the end of my finger.
Mm-hmm.
It ends at the tip of my dick or at my toes or mm-hmm. at the top of my head. Whereas the reality is that my energy sphere, my sphere of influence, goes as far or as short a distance as I want it to.
Mm-hmm.
Or really, maybe it just goes.
Mm-hmm.
It goes anywhere, everywhere, and nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, we're coming to a conclusion here on part one, Mark, but mm-hmm. let's discuss one term that we haven't talked about, which is one of Bob's key terms, and keep it in theme of what you're talking about. Is the discarnate state tactile, and how do you define the discarnate state?
Is it or is it not tactile?
Right. Well, first of all, define the discarnate state. How you think Bob, you know, uses this term, and then talk about tactility within the discarnate state. You got about 5 minutes.
Yeah, I think the
you've got 5 minutes to explain the universe.
your mission, should you choose not to accept it, is to leave the room. So, I would basically sum up my impression of Bob's use of the word discarnate state in one word, which is extension.
And why is that?
Because when one is in the discarnate state, one is visually, as well as tactilely, as well as acoustically, extended beyond these obvious limits of, like, the body is the obvious limit of your beingness. I mean, I can tell you that anything within my reach, I can change. I can grab this cup or something and I can move it. I can change. It's harder for me to imagine that I can change things that are beyond my reach, that are out of my sight, out of earshot, so on and so forth. So when I get on the phone and I call someone over at my house and tell them to lock my door because I left it unlocked, and they go lock it, I have extended myself from where I was through the phone to my house or wherever, and lock the door. I locked the door. I perceived that it was unlocked and needed to be locked. I extended myself through the phone to reach the other person, who then, regardless of whether they transcendentally are me or not, the door gets locked because my voice reaches into the room where they were, and so on and so forth.
So it is a form of tactility.
So it is a form of tactility on one perception, but it's tactility in terms of extension, you know? I mean, there's any number of metaphors we could use, some of which are more funny than others, to explain this concept, and just saying that the discarnate state happens whenever anyone perceives of themselves transcendentally. In other words, when one's perspective leaves the human scale, or even when it doesn't, or per se, when it leaves the limitation of the human body scale, which maybe we need another term for that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we should call that the anthropocentric, where one is stuck in interpreting things as within the limits of the body, or maybe it's corporeocentric. I don't know. Maybe we have to get a good word from you, Bob.
Mm-hmm.
But when we extend beyond those limits, we're able to see with our eyes. Remember I said what you see with your eyes, you're touching. You know, it's a sense of touch. When I look at an object, I can tell with my eyes whether it's going to feel soft or feel hard or be rough or smooth. I mean, you can see that. So you're touching it. I mean, if I can see that it's smooth, it's pretty much the same as touching it with my fingers and feeling that it's smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, whether I'm blindfolded and touching a rock or looking at it, I'm both going to be able to tell you whether it's smooth or not or whether it's rough. So when I look at my television set and I see a picture of Toronto, my eyes are touching Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
I'm seeing Toronto. By the same thing, if we were looking at a movie from 1948 of Jack Kerouac beating on bongo drums, we are touching out to that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so in a sense, the discarnate state is tactile, but only tactile by extension, not tactile in the direct sense of that our body, our anthropocentric, our corporeocentric entity is stimulated through what we conventionally conceive of as a sense of touch. I certainly cannot feel with my fingertips the hair of a woman I'm talking to on the phone.
Right.
But I am being touched and touching her with my words. So I'm not having the sensation of my fingertips moving through hair. But if she's talking to me about how she just dyed her hair red and she just put conditioner on it, my mind will extend an image inside of me with my interior vision and my interior sense of touch. Maybe that's the key thing to say. We were talking about the senses and their interior corresponding, whereas there's a visual, a outer vision and an inner vision. There's there's an outer hearing and an inner hearing. Okay. Maybe the type of tactility we're talking about is an inner tactility, a tactility of the inner sense of touch.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the same inner sense of touch, which I have also said, goes through all of which all of the outer senses are basically a subset of that inner sense of touch.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost as though, it was. This may be a good metaphor, it's like your hand.
Mm-hmm.
Your hand has five fingers on it, And they each are different, but they're the same, too. They each have a certain number of joints in them, and they've each got fingernails and so on. So if they have similar things, and let's say that the fact that they all have fingernails represents the fact that they all function in the of registering the outside world. But, like, all my fingers are attached to the palm of my hand. And that palm of my hand is that interior touching. And it's the ground or the basis of all of those senses.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sense, the discarnate tactility is a return to essential original tactility or ultimate. Remember,
mm-hmm.
Original or ultimate is being the same. I think we're going to run out of tape here. But maybe I've addressed your question. Maybe I haven't. I really haven't said what I think the discarnate state is. Basically, a state of participation within any form of media.
Yeah.
I mean, like I said, where the effects of your consciousness directly and visually, maybe, or outside sense registering, seem to be going beyond the limits of your being.
All right. That sounds good.
Okay.
All right. And we'd like to thank Mark Free for participating in Contemporary Communications Conference on analyzing the Bob Dobbs article, Entertainment Sucks. Mark's an unknown... What are you?
I think now I'm an unusual significant American.
And a multimedia composer. And my name is Jerry Fielke. And thanks to Jeff Davison for being the engineer. And thanks to Bob, too.
Yeah, next time, bobbing for apples. Try pages 6 through infinitum.
That's it.